This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, composer Nicholas Britell, is nominated for an Oscar for his score for the film If Beale Street Could Talk. He wrote the score for Vice, which is nominated for Best Picture, and his score for Moonlight was nominated for an Oscar. He also wrote the music for The Big Short, Adam McKay's comedy explaining the financial crisis of 2007 and 2008. When McKay asked Britell to compose the music, McKay didn't know that Britell had formerly worked as a currency trader at Bear Stearns and was fluent in the language of Wall Street. Other music by Britell you might know include the theme for the HBO series Succession and spirituals and work songs he wrote for the film 12 Years a Slave. Britell had once planned to be a classical concert pianist. He studied at Juilliard's pre-college program. At Harvard, he studied psychology and the neuropsychology of music, how music works on our brain and therefore our emotions. Let's start with a scene from If Beale Street Could Talk, which is adapted from the James Baldwin novel of the same name, set in Harlem in the early 70s. The main characters, a 19-year-old woman, Tish, and a 22-year-old man, Fonny, have become lovers after being best friends since childhood. But they're forced to communicate from opposite sides of thick glass after he's wrongly accused of rape and sent to jail. In a flashback scene, she's on the subway with Fonny, thinking about the time when they were young children and took baths together. Listen for Britell's underscoring, the music underneath the voiceover.
I don't remember that we ever had any curiosity concerning each other's bodies. Fonny loved me too much. And that meant that there had never been any occasion for shame between us. We were a part of each other, flesh of each other's flesh, which we so took for granted that we never thought of the flesh. And yet, it was no surprise to me when I finally understood that he was the most beautiful person I had seen in all my life.
Nicholas Britell, welcome to Fresh Air. Congratulations on your Oscar nomination. That music is so beautiful that we heard under that scene, and it's so fitting for her recalling this beautiful time in her life about a person who she's so in love with. The music you composed for this movie isn't the music that the characters would be listening to. The music they or their parents would be listening to, like Coltrane or Miles, Nina Simone. I think I heard Al Green in the background.
Yes.
are played on records that they're listening to. Beale Street, from which the title derives, and Harlem, where the film is set, they're both famous for jazz. So it must have been a very conscious decision not to write a jazz score. So tell us about that decision.
You know, my goal is to try to find a sound that hopefully feels like it resonates in some way with the movie. And I find oftentimes that sound isn't necessarily something that seems clear at first. You know, with Beale Street, it's my second chance to work with Barry Jenkins. And, you know, one of the wonderful things that we get the chance to do is we talk before he shoots the film, actually. So Barry on Beale Street said to me that he was hearing the sound of brass and horns. That was really what he said. You know, and I think there was an idea of jazz and mid-20th century jazz, but he said, you know, I'm hearing brass and horns. And so I went off and, you know, started experimenting with trumpets and flugelhorns and cornet and French horns. And I remember I wrote some music and hadn't seen any footage. And then I played the pieces for Barry, just a couple pieces, and he loved them. But when we put them up against some early sequences of the movie, it just wasn't quite right. It was definitely missing something. And, you know, through our process and through, you know, exploring the film together, we discovered that if I actually took that music that I had written for brass and started writing it for cellos in particular, that is how we sort of opened this door to this feeling of love. And this, you know, the cellos really became for us this symbol of love, because the movie is about love and injustice.
I still want to know why you didn't do something that was more specifically jazz.
And I think that in the world of the characters in the film, I knew that Barry was interested in having on the record player, for example, Miles Davis, Blue and Green, or John Coltrane, you know, I Wish I Knew. And for me, I think there is, you know, there's always this question of, you know, do you want to hear what you're seeing, in a sense? You know, like we, you know, in some places, in certain films, you know, you the music, the score will enhance what you're seeing. But I often find that when you hear something that may be different than what you're seeing, it almost gives you this, almost like neurologically, like you hear something that's different, and so your brain kind of creates a new association in a way.
So the music you wrote for Beale Street, it strikes me that you didn't want the music to overpower the characters. I'm going to compare that to music that you wrote for Vice, the Adam McKay movie about Dick Cheney, and I want to play like the opening credit theme.
Sure. Okay.
For Vice, and it's a very turbulent theme. You know, it's piano, and you know, it becomes increasingly discordant as it goes on, and you know, it basically says like things aren't going to be going quite right.
Exactly.
So let's hear the opening credit theme from Vice, and this music is composed by my guest Nicholas Britell, and the movie is nominated for an Oscar for Best Film. Part of the opening credit music from the film Vice, music composed by my guest Nicholas Britell. So I love that piece of music. I'd listen to that in a concert hall.
Thank you.
tell us about what you were trying to do with it.
So that actually was the last thing I wrote for Vice before we finished the film. And from the very beginning, you know, I'd talked to Adam McKay, our director of Vice, and I'd first worked with Adam on The Big Short. And from early on, his first ideas, you know, we were talking about those first ideas that kind of, you know, you receive this guidance from a director when they have an instinct. And his instinct was, this story is so large. You know, not only is Vice the story of Dick Cheney, this man and his rise through Washington and the repercussions of his actions, it's also really the story of America over the past 50, 60 years. And thus, it's clearly also the story of America's impact on the world over those years. So this is such a large story that Adam felt, you know, we need a symphonic scope. It has to be, you know, we should have a large, why don't you write a symphony, you know, for this movie? And that's a, you know, it's an amazing opportunity, but it's also a question of, well, what does that symphony sound like? Like, were I to write a symphony? And so I thought to myself, you know, I think we have in our, you know, back of our minds a sense of, is there an American symphonic sound? You know, I think there are certain things that we may think of when someone says that. What's an American symphonic sound? And I think there's also an idea we have of like a hero's journey. What does a hero's journey sound like? You know, maybe it's a brass fanfare or something like that. But I felt right away that this isn't that movie. You know, this is a movie that has dissonance to it. It's the dissonance has to be integral and woven into the nature of the notes themselves. So I actually started to experiment with ideas where I could take a melodic idea, let's say, and what if I inserted the, quote, wrong notes? You know, what if I said, here's a heroic theme, but these notes are wrong, so we're constantly feeling a rub. You know, there's a dissonance somewhere. And I actually use dissonance as a sort of a guiding principle where every piece in the score has a dissonance.
Let's talk about writing the score for Moonlight. The first thing I want to do is play the theme. And I should say there's three different versions of this theme because the film is about three different chapters in this character's life. And the character early on in the film, in chapter one, he's a young African-American boy growing up in Florida. His mother is a crack addict. And he's a small and very, very quiet boy. There's a lot going on beneath the surface, but he doesn't say very much. So this is his theme. The violin is played so quietly and tentatively. It's very much like the boy who's afraid or too afraid or too shy or too inhibited to really speak much. And it's like the violinist is almost afraid to fully bow the strings, to fully like connect with the strings.
That's such a great point that you bring that up because that really was what I was going for there. The violin's played by Tim Fain, who's just a stunning violinist. And the way we recorded it actually was we put the violin very, very close to the mic, and I asked Tim to basically play the notes as quietly as he possibly could while still having the confidence of the note feeling, you know, because you can play it so quietly that it loses some of its inner strength. But so he found this pressure where it was just at the point where it felt confident, and yet it was so quiet. And because it was close mic, you had the sound of the bow hair. You know, I like keeping, in a lot of recordings actually, really as almost an aesthetic choice, I like hearing the sound of the instruments and hearing the, you know, hearing the noises and the textures that instruments make, you know, hearing the air in the room, hearing the, you know, I think that makes it feel real and beautiful to me. And so then I took the violin that we'd recorded very closely and I ran it through some reverb where there's actually a subtle amount of very long-tailed reverb on it too, which just gives the violin this extra feeling of, I don't know, almost like a mist or something around the notes. And I think, you know, there is that feeling of tenderness, hopefully. There's this feeling of, you know, there's an intimacy that I wanted that to feel like. And Tim just played that so beautifully.
When you were in Harvard, you studied psychology and you studied neuromusicology, which means basically studying how music works on the brain and therefore how music works on you when you're listening. Are there principles of neuromusicology that you learned that you've applied as a composer?
You know, yeah, when I was in school, I was a psychology concentrator, and I had always been fascinated with questions of, you know, why do certain chords feel a certain way or do they feel a certain way? You know, asking with the really sort of deep questions of like, what is music and why does it impact us at all? Because I think music is so ever-present in our lives today that I think sometimes we almost take for granted how mysterious it is that there are these vibrations in the air, these frequencies that combine that hit our ears and that we then create deep complexes of emotion out of. You know, it's this incredibly mysterious thing that we really don't know that much about. And, You know, with neuromusicology specifically, I mean, there are so many interesting questions. And actually, I think it's only deepened the mystery for me. It hasn't clarified things. It actually made me have more questions, where I think growing up, I used to think, for example, that a major chord was happy and a minor chord was sad. And now I don't. I actually think that it's all about context. And I think that sometimes the saddest music is with major chords, and the most inspiring music that feels like true perseverance can be with minor chords.
You studied piano, classically trained. You went to Juilliard's pre-college program. For a while, you hoped to be a concert pianist. So when you chose not to become a concert pianist, it's not like you immediately became a film composer. You spent some time as a currency trader on Wall Street. And that is not a direct route from concert pianist. It's a really, to me, inexplicable detour that your life took. So please explain how you went from deciding, yeah, I'm not going to be a concert pianist, to being a currency trader, and exactly what credentials did you have to become one?
That's a great question. So when I was in college, the way in which I got started with film music and really furthered my own music was I joined a hip-hop band that friends of mine had started and called the Witness Protection Program. And I was passionate about the band and actually wrote so much music over those years. And exactly at that same period of time when I was writing so much music for the band, my very dear friend Nick Lavelle, who tragically passed away a few years ago, who's an amazing director, he asked me if I had ever scored a film and would I like to score the $10,000 feature film that he was making while we were at Harvard. And I said, let's do it. Let's try it out. So in college, my whole life was really scoring Nick's film and, you know, playing with my band all the time. And at the end of college, the movie didn't come out and it wasn't clear when it was going to come out. I thought, you know, maybe this movie will come out in 6 months or a year, you know, so that wasn't very clear what was happening. And then the band broke up. You know, and we decided to part ways. And at that moment, I actually interviewed with someone who had gone to Harvard, who himself was a composer. And he worked in finance. And he said, you know what? We can find something for you to do. So I ended up, he ended up hiring me, and I learned to trade currencies and was exposed to this whole other world of international finance. And, you know, we focused on currencies and emerging market currencies specifically and interest rates. And while I was doing that during the day, I was scoring short films. I would give concerts even. Actually, I gave a concert for our investors. You know, I would do that. I would write all I would write all sorts of music. I wrote telephone hold music, you know.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. I remember writing telephone hold music and having a friend of mine who got me the gig. He was like, do you want to do this? I was like, absolutely. And I wrote this kind of almost like spa-like music, and all my friends would call this restaurant and ask to be placed on hold. So that was, you know, but you know, I loved it. I just loved writing music.
So I want to play part of the music that you wrote for The Big Short, and this is the opening music. In the film, there's a voiceover by Ryan Gosling, who's talking about, like, the old days of Wall Street when, you know, investment banking was a kind of like boring business. It was a boring, slow world. And so here's the music that you wrote to accompany that voiceover about the boring business of banking in the old days. That's music from the film The Big Short. That is so unlike what we've been hearing. What were you thinking of when you wrote this? I'll start by saying it's a kind of old-fashioned waltz.
Yes, exactly.
And like very like middle of the road, almost like sedated, you know, like a like you take it from there.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I think there was an idea of what I talked about with Adam was this feeling of almost like old Americana. You know, back in the day, Wall Street was boring. It was sleepy in a way, maybe as it should be. You know, I think, you know, I definitely am of the view that certain industries, especially when they are so, you know, crucial to the functioning of the world and the economy, maybe they should be a little boring. You know, maybe they should be like the utility system. You know, you don't want the public utility system to be exciting. I think, if the electrical grid was exciting all the time, maybe that would be bad. So banking was boring. And there was this idea of just that old, sort of old sound, old Americana waltz, sleepy waltz. And then Adam said to me, I wrote that piece, and Adam said, maybe there should be one thing that's just weird. Like, how do we make it a little weird? And so there's this sound I did of a electric keyboard, like a Wurlitzer, that I ran through a tape, like a wild sort of tape filter that gave it this almost kind of like bizarro alien kind of sound. So there's this very boring waltz, but right in the middle of it, there's some strangeness kind of just seeding that idea that maybe things are going somewhere different.
Is that music that we just heard from The Big Short anything like the hold music that you wrote for when people are put on hold?
That's funny. It isn't, and I recently went back and tried to find that hold music.
I want to hear that so bad.
I was curious about it. The hold music I wrote, I remember, was much more like the music you'd hear at a spa. You know, it was that kind of like very sort of almost like twinkly kind of piano and very delicate, you know, soothing texture. So not worlds away from this, but not as musically structured in a way there, where the boring old banking track has sort of a progression. And I would say the whole music was more sort of had a stasis to it.
That kind of spa music just really drives me crazy because I know it's supposed to calm me down, but I find it like really irritating because I don't like the music.
Well, if I find my hold music, I will send it to you. Maybe mine won't, you know, bother you. But you never know. You never know. I don't know.
So I just have to ask you, what were your goals? Because whenever you write, you're writing with a goal, with an emotional and narrative mission in mind. So when you were writing hold music, what was your goal?
My goal was to, you know, make your experience on hold as pleasurable as possible. I think it really was to, you know, if you have to be on hold, you know, you might as well have some music that doesn't make you want to, you know, hang up the phone too quickly. So I was hoping that if it was this sort of soothing atmosphere, maybe theoretically, it would make your time on hold more enjoyable.
Nicholas Britell, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for your music.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really a pleasure.
Nicholas Britell's score for If Beale Street Could Talk is nominated for an Oscar. 50 years ago, pianist Oscar Peterson and a studio orchestra recorded an album with their versions of songs from the 1960s, including this one. Ode to Billy Joe was written and originally recorded by Bobby Gentry and became a number one hit in 1967. The version we heard is from the Oscar Peterson album Motions and Emotions, which has been reissued by the German label MPS. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead confesses to mixed feelings about this album.
Pianist Oscar Peterson on one of Burt Bacharach's less inspired melodies, This Guy's in Love with You. It's from Peterson's newly reissued Motions and Emotions from 1969. Oscar Peterson was one of the most fluent jazz pianists, and this impeccably played session was orchestrated by Klaus Ogerman, jazz and pop arranger who'd recently worked up a nice album of backrack tunes for saxophonist Stan Getz. But Ogerman plus Peterson edges closer to Tinkling Piano Cocktail Hour. That aesthetic is out of late 60s Hollywood love stories. The low, murmuring flutes and bossa nova guitars add class with a chef's kiss. Mwah. Old and new liner notes attest to this album's value and good taste. I wouldn't go that far, but something fascinates me about this music. Partly it's the disparity between the big canvas and the modest ambition. Orchestral forces marshaled to produce easy-listening pop covers. In the 1960s, lots of respectable jazz musicians covered AM radio hits, but it wasn't always a good fit. In fairness, the Beatles tunes Oscar Peterson does here, Yesterday and Eleanor Rigby, had string sections even on the Beatle versions. Still, the line between good taste and bad gets blurry here. Oscar Peterson sounds a bit ambivalent himself. The pianist may noodle his way through a melody, laying low till a tune's second half. Once he gets going, he doesn't need the orchestra's help, but that doesn't mean he won't get it. Arranger Klaus Ogerman turning Bobby Hebb's jazzy pop hit Sunny into an action TV theme. When Oscar Peterson does get revved up, his playing gets fast and fleet, but sometimes it's empty flash, as if the material didn't really inspire him. My own mixed reaction to Peterson's Motions and Emotions, both amused and unamused, is partly due to its unevenness, tottering between agreeably swinging jazz and frilly excess. So listening to it is a little like watching a bad movie with a few good scenes. On some level, you can like and dislike it at the same time. That's pretty deep for shallow music.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Point of Departure and is the author of Why Jazz. He reviewed the reissue Motions and Emotions by Oscar Peterson. Coming up, we talk with writer Sigrid Nunez. Her latest novel, The Friend, won the National Book Award for Fiction. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Our next guest is writer Sigrid Nunez, who won the National Book Award for Fiction last November for her novel, The Friend, which will be published in paperback February 5th. It begins with the narrator, a woman, at the memorial of a dear friend who killed himself. He was more than a friend. Years earlier, he'd been her writing professor and mentor. When she was his student, they slept together, once, at his suggestion. She wasn't the only student he seduced. but her friendship with him outlasted his 3 marriages and many affairs. After his death, she reluctantly inherits his dog, a 180-pound Great Dane, who, like her, is grieving. The novel is filled with reflections about the line between appropriate and inappropriate relations between students and teachers, what it's like to mourn a friend who left no note explaining his suicide, the bond that can develop between a dog and a person, and how being a writer has changed in the world of social media. Let's start with a reading from early in the novel, after the narrator has learned that her friend has taken his life. She's wondering, why?
Because of the timing, so near the start of the year, it was possible to think that it had been a resolution. One of those times when you talked about it, you said that what would stop you was your students. Naturally, you were concerned about the effect such an example might have on them. Nevertheless, we thought nothing of it when you quit teaching last year, even though we knew that you liked teaching and that you needed the money. Another time you said that, for a person who had reached a certain age, it could be a rational decision, a perfectly sound choice, a solution even, unlike when a young person commits suicide, which could never be anything but a mistake. Once you cracked us up with the line, "I think I'd prefer a novella of a life." Stevie Smith calling death the only God who must come when he's called tickled you pink, as did the various ways people have said that were it not for suicide, they could not go on. Walking with Samuel Beckett one fine spring morning, a friend of his asked, "Doesn't a day like this make you glad to be alive?" "I wouldn't go as far as that," Beckett said. That there was to be a memorial took us by surprise. We who had heard you say that you would never want any such thing, the very idea was repugnant to you. Did wife 3 simply choose to ignore this? Was it because you'd failed to put it in writing? Like most suicides, you did not leave a note.
That was Sigrid Nunez reading from her novel, The Friend, which comes out in paperback February 5th. And won the National Book Award for Fiction. So this novel has a lot to do with suicide and trying to understand why somebody did it. Have you lost someone to suicide?
Yes, I have. And before I started writing this book, one of the main reasons why I wanted to write about suicide was because I realized that I knew quite a few people who had the idea of suicide on their minds. I mean, they might not have been actually planning it, but they'd come to believe that this was how their story would end. It was a choice that was very much on their minds all the time, not just at moments of despair. And I had finished the novel, though it hadn't been published yet, when one of those people did commit suicide.
How did that person take their life?
He jumped from the Golden Gate Bridge.
And what did it make you think about thinking of the way that person chose to end it?
I actually think that when people make that decision, it's such a mystery, in fact. I don't think it's so easy to understand what is on people's minds when they actually attempt the suicide. I do know that people who have jumped and have survived, no small number of them have said afterwards that as soon as their hands let go, or as soon as they were in the air, they regretted it. And then afterwards, when they were saved, they were happy to have been saved. So I have to have that in my mind, that might have happened to him too.
It must hurt for you to think about that.
Certainly, and I was not in touch with him right before he killed himself, and there was no note. So I really don't know exactly what his thoughts were. Now, he was somebody who had been suicidal during his life and who suffered from depression. and had been very unhappy. But still, even when a suicide like that happens, it can come as an extraordinary shock while at the same time not really being a surprise. I was not surprised. In fact, when I came home from teaching and I saw an email from a mutual friend that said, "Call me when you get this message," I knew instantly that he had committed suicide, this man.
When a friend of yours talks about the temptation of suicide, what do you say? You know, do you try to talk them out of it? Do you try to just listen?
Oh, I try to just listen. My friend who jumped from the bridge, suicide was something he talked about all the time, and the different ways that he might do it. Also, when you know that somebody is feeling this way, you know, you make all those suggestions about places to get in touch with people who might be able to help, to go into therapy if you aren't already. But I think it's very, very hard for people to deal with other people's suicidal feelings because it's so extreme. Self-homicide, self-murder, it's so against the normal course of things. And since I wrote this book, I receive so many emails all the time from people who have lost people, in some cases very recently, to suicide. And I do have to think of ways to answer those emails, and I do. I answer every one of them.
Another issue that your novel deals with is relationships between professors and students, specifically between male professors and female students, and the attraction that can form between them. The main character is a woman, and the character who kills himself, her very dear friend, had been her college professor years ago. And they even had a brief affair after he told her they should try sleeping together because he said, "We should find that out about each other." And she says, "I don't think it ever occurred to either of us that I might refuse." And then he tells her that, "Well, it's not really going to work out." And she's kind of devastated, but they remain good friends. He marries three times. They remain good friends throughout all those marriages. She's never quite sure what the wives feel about their relationship. And he tells her, to be a teacher is to be a seducer. And there are times when he must also be a heartbreaker. Have you heard men say that about teaching, that to be a teacher is to be a seducer?
I have. And I believe in this case, he is paraphrasing something that was said by George Steiner. If not in those words, or let's just put it this way, if not in words, in some cases, that message is there. I have certainly heard that.
It strikes me as such a male thing. Like, I don't think women teachers, women professors see themselves that way, unless you're talking about seducing people into learning. But I don't think women teachers see themselves as wanting to flirt and maybe go to bed with their students. I'm not saying all men do either, but I think it's, over the years, been a more common thing for men than for women.
Well, that might be true, but I do think that women, female mentors and women in positions of power, do indeed have that same feeling. They might not carry it all the way through, but wanting to seduce their mentees or their students. But I think you can understand that, what that, you know, that doesn't seem so strange to me that a young person would say that. And then I think as a mentor, Susan Sontag certainly was extremely seductive and was fully aware of how magnetic and charismatic and seductive she was to men and women in that role. It was a huge part of her personality.
Seductive in the literal sense of, like, I'm going to try to convince you to sleep with me, or just seductive at a distance? Yeah.
Both. Both. It would depend on the person.
Mm-hmm.
But Sontag used to talk about that, about her how when she had any kind of affection or strong feeling for anyone, she always also wanted to sleep with that person. That was part of it. Now, she didn't always, of course, but it was always there. There was always some attraction like that or some desire there. But as I say, just to remember her, I can't separate that seductive quality of hers out from the rest.
I was going to say, just to put that in context, when you were in your 20s, I think,
yes,
you were a couple with David Reif, Susan Sontag's son. She at the time was diagnosed with cancer. You were both living with Susan Sontag. She became a friend and mentor to you, and you got to see her at her best and her worst.
Yes.
Okay. The story in The Friend, the narrator is a woman whose mentor from college, who was close to her age, became a dear friend, and he has just committed suicide. She's left grieving and wondering why. And she also inherits his dog. And it's not just like any dog. It's a 180-pound Great Dane. And she lives in a small rent-controlled apartment in New York. And it's illegal. It's against the regulations to have a dog in that apartment. So she kind of violates the regulations, takes the dog kind of reluctantly. And they become very close. And they're both grieving. The dog is grieving, too. But as you've said, you can't describe death to a dog. You can't explain death to a dog.
Yeah, that's something that has struck me well before I started writing this book, how difficult that is, really, because, you know, there the dog is at home. As far as the dog knows, everything is fine. And then the person, the dog's person, the most beloved one, vanishes into thin air, just isn't there anymore. There is no way to explain to the dog what happened. And it just seems to me that must be a remarkable emotional tumult for the dog.
She walks the street with the dog. You know, she takes the dog on walks, as of course you have to. Because the dog is so big, she feels like she's a spectacle when she's on the street with the dog. And everybody's like stopping and wanting to do a selfie or asking how much he eats or how much he defecates. and she's kind of, you know, I think she feels like partly her privacy is being invaded, but partly just like amused by the whole thing. But it connects to something larger that her friend who took his life used to say, which is that, you know, he used to like love to walk and felt like he did his best writing while he was walking and just kind of losing himself in his thoughts and in his surroundings. But he always thought that would be harder for a woman to do because a woman always has to be on guard. Is this guy following me? Is this guy going to grope me? Is this guy going to attack me? What about that cat call? And so I'm wondering if you thought about that from both directions, about, you know, the difficulties of sometimes losing yourself as a woman who has to be on guard when walking the streets, and the difference when you have this like a huge dog who everybody wants to stop and admire when you're walking.
Well, it's true that I was writing about Flannery and the flaneur who was an urban walker.
That's a French word.
Yes, and the mentor's idea that, you know, can there really be such a thing as a flâneuse? Can a woman be a flâneur? Because real flânerie requires that you are able to lose yourself in an urban setting and just walk and dream and discover, and that is very difficult for a woman. Now, if we were talking about walking in the country, that would be different, but that's not what a flâneur does. It did strike me, I guess, just as an idea when I was writing, that of course it is true what he says, that a woman is raised to be always on guard. Is there someone behind me? Is there, you know, is and not to mention remarks that are made or stares that are given. That certainly does make it much different for a woman than for a man. And with my narrator walking with the dog, she does feel embarrassed. She's a very private person, and she doesn't want to be interrupted constantly when she's taking the dog for a walk. And then there's a certain amount of irritation with the same things always being said, like, why don't you ride him? And as you say, how much does he eat? And also people putting in their two cents, such as, it's a sin, a crime, as one woman says, I think it's a crime to keep a dog that large in the city, or that dog shouldn't be in the city, which is something that people do say if you walk a big dog.
I'm guilty of being one of the people who say, how much does the dog eat? Well, I could probably ride the dog, because I literally could probably ride the dog. I mean, I'm so short. I could really probably do it. I want to end with the quote that opens your book. It's a quote from Nicholson Baker. And the quote is, the question any novel is really trying to answer is life worth living? No, that's a great quote to open a novel that has a lot to do with suicide. But does that also sum up your idea of what writers really are trying to write about?
Yes, I was so struck by that quote. And I found that quote, that's from his Paris Review interview. The book was finished when I found that, and I... you know, by chance, I just happened to read the interview, and I thought it was so perfect, so perfectly expressed, and a bit shocking when you think about it. But I think it's absolutely true. And I'm so grateful to him for having said that.
Sigrid Nunes, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me, Terry.
And congratulations on winning the National Book Award.
Thank you. Thank you.
Sigrid Nunes' novel, The Friend, won the 2018 National Book Award for Fiction. It comes out in paperback February 5th. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mood Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross. ¶¶